Hello, I'm Joel Porter, and on behalf of my friend Steve Rolnick, we'd like to welcome you to the 2024 Motivational Interviewing and Beyond webinar and podcast. The topic we chose to try to explore was harm, and Steve created a word called harmology to try to bring this to the forefront of people's minds to be aware of the harms that can unintentionally happen when we're trying to help people. We had a nice discussion with Brendan Murphy and Sean Shelley and Heather Flynn and other people exploring this area and trying to kind of gain a deeper understanding. We probably ended up with more questions than we had answers, but we had some wonderful commentary from the chat, some people that popped in as guests. So we really hope you enjoy this webinar. You may have noticed that we switched to quarterly instead of monthly. That's just because Steve and I have things we need to do. And I'm thinking I'm going to do some MI mini podcasts. So look for those down in the future. And we'll just see where it all goes. So enjoy the conversation. Please add your comments if you'd like, and we really appreciate it. Well, off we go. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good day to everybody who's come along. Welcome to the first Motivational Interviewing and Beyond of 2024. We've shifted some things around and decided to do this four times a year instead of 12 times a year, so we could have some time to do some other things as well. We're very grateful to Heather Flynn and her team at Florida State University for hosting us. We're partnering with MIB, and Heather always has good things to say, so she can jump right in anytime. She doesn't need to ask permission. But now let's start our first webinar, Steve, with a very uplifting topic. Let's talk about harm.
Joel, I think it's gonna beg the question, what is helpful? So let's keep that positive spin in mind, but John, I'll tell you what happened, okay? I spent these decades in the field of counseling and therapy, okay? And then after I retired, I stepped outside of it into schools and now elite sports, and I got the shock of my life. Because I was living in this refined world as a researcher and clinician. Stepped outside and I was deeply shocked by what I saw. Okay. And I'd spent decades doing research on what works well, what kind of therapy produces what kind of outcome, always looking for positive effects and ignoring the opposite because it was messy. It was like a statistical nuisance. So it was I kind of thought, well, hang on, that's probably a big mistake, because there's a lot of harmful conversations happening and we should have studied this. So then I came up with this idea of like harmology, but maybe it could be something called helpology or helpfulness. I don't know, but that's where it came from for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the first time you started using the word harmology. It was a good while ago. We've been meaning to have this conversation for over a year. And certainly, you know, most of, as a psychologist, most of what we study is what works. We don't spend a whole lot of time researching what doesn't work, or there's not a huge literature on, harms caused in therapy. There's some there, but there's not a lot. And so I'm really curious you know, about how nuanced this can be, because, you know, there's different, you know, I guess what I'd like to hear from you, Steve, is I was kind of trying to put my head around, how do we approach this topic? You know, how do we frame it up? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how we kind of at least begin this conversation and define the boundaries of harm and harmology.
Exactly. You know, that maybe this is a branch of harmology that we're talking about. We're not, but in this webinar, we're not talking about harm in general, like beating up a child or stealing from a friend. Obviously, that can undoubtedly cause harm. But a branch of homology, so to speak.
It's so quite often a... Stephen Rolnick, Tala.
If you could please...
Hello, mute, all. Please mute yourself if you're not speaking. Thank you so much.
And it's quite a strange one, because I think we're talking about harm caused when you're meant to be helping.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And the harm is to mental and physical health. And therapists are not the only ones who help other people. That was the shock I got, right? When I moved out in sport, right? So the net's quite a wide one. And I can imagine this embraces teachers, parents, friends, sports coaches, ministers of religion, who all are meant to be helping, but are causing harm. How's that for a boundary?
That's a big boundary. But that's okay. I mean, that's the way when we were kind of trying to present what our idea was. It's the unintended harm, you know, or the, you know, and I think at one point I was thinking like the shadow side of helping, but not in an intentional way of harming people, right? It's not like, you know, the therapist who has sex with their client. Or, exploits financially a client. We're not talking about that kind of harm. There's enough evidence that goes on. And that's a whole different issue.
Exactly, Joel. I tell you, when I walked into sports, I saw like these four types of harm. I tried to sort of reflect about what they were. If you like, sadists and abusers is one kind. You know, they're truly dangerous outliners, but I've seen them. Okay. Another kind would be, I suppose, deliberate but ignorant people who cause harm. The teacher or parent who speaks unkindly to a kid and undermines them. They just don't know any better. They've never thought about it, and it's a pity that's not studied. And then there's a weird category, which are bullshitters. And I've seen this a lot. Sport, they struggle to see the truth of harm because they make up their own rules and rituals, and then they believe in them as if they're true about what is a good way to be with other people. So you get someone like the very self-involved sports coach who thinks they're some kind like a hero figure like Jurgen Klopp or Alex Ferguson, and they feel perfectly free because these hero figures behaved like this. They feel perfectly free to give young athletes what they call the hairdryer treatment. And this kind of coach I've seen firsthand, who sort of yells incessantly at young people and makes them do punishment drills, for example. I've seen 16-year-old semi-professional soccer players on professional contracts vomiting in a punishment drill, being publicly shamed by a coach, dropped from the team and hung out to dry by a bullshitter who considered this normal. And then I think there's a fourth category, right, which is what I imagined you would be most interested in, which is the unintended harmers, like the therapist who sincerely believes they're helping when it's not. Can I give you a personal example?
Yeah, absolutely, Steve.
As a troubled young man struggling with loss, looking back, this is 50 years, I went to this counselor who had me regressed in a fetal position on the floor, accessing what he thought was some early infant issue. Okay, so there I am on the floor, and it failed miserably as a technique. Okay, I tell you something weird. 40 years later, I met him, and he seemed just as self-assured. How many, you know, I can say that harmed me, okay? But how many people has he seen in the last 40 years, okay? So that's another type of harm, the sort of unintended. He doesn't intend to harm people. He just got such a strong conviction about the value of what he's doing that he does it to or on them. So there you go. I don't know if that's helpful.
I think those four categories are really helpful. You know, the sadists and the cruel people that are getting pleasure or some sort of benefit out of causing harm to other people, we can push them to the sidelines for now. The ignorant kind of people are real. I mean, really interested in those folks as well too. You know, when you were talking about the bullshitters, I was thinking about Bobby Knight, the University of Indiana basketball coach back in the 80s or 70s, who used to scream and yell at his players during the game. But then the last category, yeah, definitely, you know. And then I don't know where this person fits in there. And it's kind of maybe that last category. It's the people I've come across, particularly in the alcohol and drug field, who tend to be more authoritative, confrontational, you know, challenging. This is what worked for me, so it should work for you.
Yeah. And we can see that's where MI came from.
Yeah.
Motivational interviewing for both Miller and I, we saw unintended harm happening. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
a tricky one because people genuinely believe it. That, the only hammer I have, only tool I have is a hammer. So every client I treat like a nail, you know. And the problem with that is I remember, I think it was Alan Zukoff and I were talking about this, said the problem with that is intermittent reinforcement because every now and then it works.
Exactly. You know? And we could go into this. I'm more interested in the wider terrain outside of therapy.
Okay, let's go wide and come in.
Can I just say, to provoke people, I get a creepy feeling about the trauma field. Trauma this and trauma that. And I get a really creepy feel, given that experience of mine personally that I just described, where there's this assumption that someone's got to explore my trauma.
I'll leave it to you to push that provocative boat out into the water. I'm on board. I talked to somebody who went to a private rehab a couple of years ago, and their fundamental belief was that everybody who has an addiction problem has a trauma issue. You just have to dig deep enough to find it. And once you find it, you can resolve the addiction.
That's what this guy thought about me. Yeah.
Well, and I remember the 80s and the rebirthing and wrapping people up in blankets and holding people down and beating things with bats and that sort of abreactive or emotional release kind of therapy. You know, you felt something, but did it actually change anything? And for people who have been traumatized, all that could be is re-traumatizing, in a sense. You know, I had a colleague of mine who used to say, "Do you want to feel better, or do you want to get better?" You know, and sometimes people mistake feeling better or feeling strong emotion as a positive outcome. And actually, I did read some literature on that years ago, and there's no evidence to support it that having big emotional releases in therapy actually leads to long enduring change.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting question, which we'll look into this evening. I reckon we should look into that. And we've got Brendan on the line, and I've got a question for Brendan as somebody whom I deeply respect and who's looked into this. But
Scott, can you bring Brendan up? Can you spotlight Brendan?
Oh, could I first just do something and point to three potential culprits? I don't mean human beings. I mean, communication devices, if you like, right? One of them is advice giving. I don't mean advice giving in itself, but very poor quality advice giving. I think good quality advice giving is magical. But overwhelmingly, it's the case that most advice giving is very poorly done, from what I've seen when I stepped out into sport and education. You know, there's a wonderful quote from somebody called Imuna Braverman. I don't know who she is, but it's this: maybe you only really qualify to give advice when you truly recognize how little you know. Okay, so
that's humbling.
Contrast that with the way advice is dished out. And that's what led me to kind of coin this phrase, the deficit detective, who turns it into a way of life, spotting problems in other people. And it's usually accompanied by labeling and blaming, a lack of trust, lack of understanding, a lack of choice for the receiver. So we can unpick what's going on with apparently well-intentioned advice giving, where there's a lack of trust, choice, and understanding. And if they're absent, I hypothesize that harm is being done. Okay. But then there's another culprit. Could I mention that? And then I'm going to step back and let you run the webinar, right? Which is positive psychology and empathy. I've got worried about positive psychology and empathy, even though MI, motivational interviewing, is a form. And I worry about this because I've noticed that it can give rise to this idea that empathy is a good thing. And surely not. Hundreds of times I've sat with people and empathized with their suffering and their list of problems, then got the feeling that we were simply diving into a hole of misery. Okay, I don't know how we get this idea that empathy is a good thing. And if you look beyond therapy, it surely what we learn is it depends on what the purpose and focus of your empathy is. Which is why I so like motivational interviewing, because it's purposeful, okay? But if, you know, we know that if empathy is only used for the purpose of empathizing with your own folk, it can be extremely damaging. Look at the Middle East. It's much harder to empathize with people on the other side, and people don't tend to do it. Last week, I sat down with 5 Jewish people and 5 Muslims, you know, leading people in the Muslim community. And we tried to listen to each other. Wow. I mean, that felt like a good use of empathy. But to suggest that empathy is just almost by definition a good thing, I think is naive beyond words and can be used for harmful ends.
Okay, well, I think you've given us a good start, you know, and I'm thinking about what you just said, and you know, most helpful things are like a two-sided, aren't they? Where they can cut to cause harm and they can cut to cause help. It just depends on the person doing that. And I think this would be a good time to bring Brendan up, and let him kind of take a dive into where we're at and what his thoughts are. So if Scott, if you could spotlight Mr. Murphy, that would be good. Brendan is hard to describe. Brendan, he's an amazing man. He's a brilliant man. He's a very skilled therapist. He's a dear friend of mine, and he is in Claremorris, Ireland. But if you can bring him on up, it'd be great to hear what your thoughts are as we get this conversation moving.
Joel, I've got a question for Brendan, which is it always helpful to explore emotion with empathy? There's a question for him.
That is a big one.
Yeah. Okay, that is a big one. Yeah.
We hear you, but we can't see you.
Okay, I don't know. Is that on your end?
You're pinned. It's the best I can do in a Zoom meeting.
Okay. That's cool.
So fire when ready, Brendan.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much. Here we go. I'm just a little bit thrown. I love the ground that Joel Porter walks on, but I'm embarrassed also. His introduction was so kind. Thank you, Joel. And Steve, I'm just, there's lots of thoughts flying around in my head from what you said about trauma and what you said about empathy and lots of things that I'd love to chat with you about. But particularly if we kind of start just at your question about emotion, could you just say a little bit more? Just flesh that out slightly for people, and then maybe I'll throw a few more thoughts at it.
Yeah, Brendan, you once sent me a box of cubes that you developed with labels with different emotional states. And I was very taken by them and even showed them to my kid when he was about 10. And I came away with this feeling that they were incredibly useful. So nothing I'm going to say is a criticism of you. In fact, it's because of who you are that I think you're in a good position to answer this question. It is this: is it always helpful to explore someone's feelings using empathy?
Okay. And I think it's lovely, and I'll answer it in a round immediately by saying no. So that I'll just kind of maybe start from there and then work back. The cubes that you mentioned, people won't necessarily know what you're talking about. A couple of people on the call would have seen them. So it's a tool I developed a few years ago for working in therapy with people. And there are these wooden cubes with all these different facets of emotions on each cube. And they're a really helpful way to work through emotional conversations with people, or conversations that have high degrees of emotion in them. And it's really important, I think, Steve, to name emotions. Probably the most helpful thing that we can do in regulating emotions, so that can be down-regulating them or up-regulating them, is to name an emotion and be able to have a conversation about what that person's experience of that emotion in this instance is. So we can take something very large and narrow it down to their experience of it. Because if you take something really painful, like the emotion of shame, it can have a tremendous amount of different presentations from people being like the wanting the ground to open up and swallow them up, to people suddenly acting all with a lot of bravado and making like nothing happened and I don't care and none of this affects me. But, you know, it can manifest so differently. So rather than kind of empathizing with what I think this emotion is for a person, it's really important to help a person unpack what this emotion is in this instance. So that's a really kind of helpful way, I think, of taking the large thing of emotion and empathizing with it and bringing it down to, you know, we don't empathize with emotions, we empathize with people.
Super. Well said.
Super. Oh, thank you. I just made it up on the spot.
So where can harm come into that?
If you empathize with the
emotion and not the person.
Yeah. I think it's immediately it's the one where Steve has already named it. If we know. Okay, if we empathize with some emotions, that they tend to expand. You know, what we focus on grows. Okay, so we have something like where if we take someone who's very sad and we give them a lot of empathy, it can really deepen their sadness. Now, there's an aspect of that where we empathize with some parts of a person's sadness, and it can really help them feel like they're understood and they're not alone in this.
Yes.
And one of the differences, and it's there's multiple differences, but if I could just stay with the emotion of sadness for a minute, but this applies across a lot of different emotions. Sadness is almost always triggered by loss. So loss of something that's tremendously important to us. Loss of a person, loss of status, loss of a prized item, loss of a hope for the future. So that there's some loss there like that. If we just empathize with the person who feels very sad and with their sadness in a generic sort of way, it can have a kind of contagious effect on, you know, that their life suddenly becomes full of loss and to tell you about all these other things that they're sad about. But if we're actually able to narrow it down and empathize with them on the loss that they've had in this instance, what this is like for them now, that can be tremendously helpful in them feeling understood and no longer alone in the loss that they're feeling. Does that make sense?
It's so interesting, and it's nuanced what you describe. And it's nuanced and raises the question, I wonder if the average counselor or therapist out there gets it like you do. What do you think?
Uh-uh. Well, then we're okay. Getting into people that are either ignorant or they're trying to be helpful, but they're just not.
Mm. Yeah. If sometimes, I could, if I could just pitch in something around the ignorance piece, Joel, I think there are some specific trainings, and an obvious one is something like emotion-focused therapy. Another one might be dialectical behavior therapy. Two of those that have a strong emphasis on working with emotion, and they work with emotion in wildly different ways, but they're very upfront about working with emotion. Most other approaches and most other counseling and therapy training schools train helpers or therapists very, very small amounts in emotion, in actually working with emotion. They train a lot maybe about interventions and some techniques, like Steve, what you said, and I've been that guy balled up on the floor in a fetal position doing breath work and body work, and sometimes it was helpful and sometimes it was terrible. You know, but that idea of that there is a perhaps, and I really am so conscious about saying this because the word ignorance can be misunderstood as very critical, but that there is actually an ignorance about emotion amongst an awful lot of therapists, where emotions are balled together into the category of that person is very emotional. And I mean, like that really doesn't help anybody, you know? So I think there's a level of nuance. I don't think I got anything special going on, but I think there is a level of nuance about actually saying, let's look at individual emotions a little more carefully, and let's look at the type of things that lead to people experiencing these emotions. You know, like I said, loss for sadness. And that, like, you know, things like that. So, yeah, I think there's something about the ignorance part. But again, I use that word very advisedly.
Yeah.
Heather,
Brendan, I really appreciate what you're saying. And I received permission from Joel to speak up at this juncture rather than to wait. So I'm legit as well. But no, I mean, I think, as Steve said, you brought a lot of nuance to, to start off with, can empathy be harmful? And you made a distinction between empathizing with emotions, which can actually potentially serve the function of rewarding, you know, to use a behavioral term, you know, that emotion making them stronger and bigger than they would have been otherwise. You're making a distinction between that and empathizing with the person's situations with a goal and a direction in mind, which I think is a very important qualifier for all of this. And everything. Often the people we're working with, they're very nice, and they're not sharing with us in real time, and they may not even know that it's having a harmful effect. So, you know, that gets you back to the training in tracking and working with emotion and therapy, and because it is quite nuanced. And in interpersonal psychotherapy, we spend a lot of time learning how to help the person turn up the volume on their emotions enough so that they use it as a signal to help them figure out what they need to do in their lives that will make them feel better and function better. So, but that's, you know, I don't know in motivational interviewing, I mean, we talk a lot about emotion, but it's not a formal part of the training, you know, that we receive. So I think it's, you know, really fascinating that you're making these important distinctions. And it, for me, again, it raises the question of a lot of therapists, I think we have no idea what micro harms we might be doing within the course of any session.
Yeah. Heather, look, that's just so well put. And I, you know, for people on the call who aren't aware, Heather, in terms of interpersonal psychotherapy, you know, Heather's the bomb. Heather's the real deal in the world of IPT.
As far as you know. So,
but it, I think that's pretty much an understatement, Heather. But in yeah, that idea of emotions as being a signal is really crucial. That in terms of emotions are primarily a signal to ourselves to respond in some way. They're a heuristic. They're a shortcut. What Heather describes there is so tremendously important. Helping the client recognize their emotion and then communicate that back to us. And then, of course, what we're hoping for here, I think, in terms of your starting point, Steve, that by defining this branch of harmology and helping it guide us towards what would be helpful as helpers, what we need to do then is that is help people be skilled enough to spot what the client is communicating to us. And work out what they need to happen as a result, because that idea of an emotion as a signal or maybe an unmet need, that's a really important part of working with an emotion. And if we're staying close to the client's unmet needs and trying to work around that, chances are, and I think it's the parts that Heather has brought into this here in terms of, you know, that emotions are a signal and helping clients turn up the volume, having a clear conversation with them. So we're asking them to relay that signal to us about what they need, what their unmet need is, and then we can start to follow that.
Wow. Could I just react? I mean, the elegance and nuance and what both you and Heather have said makes me feel even more depressed about harm, because I just feel surely the overwhelming majority of people who approach someone with mental health issues are not at the receiving end of the nuanced judgments that the two of you are so elegantly making. So ironically, you're reinforcing my rather gloomy old man grumpy pessimism.
So in discussing harmology, we may have caused additional harm, which is happening in real time.
Yeah. I've worked in addiction services for years, and mainly in harm minimization services or harm reduction services. And it turns out this conversation is now a harm maximization intervention for Steve.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, the reference to harm reduction might be a great opportunity, Joel, to bring in Sean.
Okay, that's fine.
I don't know what he makes of it, but I feel a little bit overwhelmed with pessimism after listening to those elegant accounts. Inspiring.
Well, I mean, I'm in my mind, Steve. I'm thinking that some of the antidote for harm, causing harm, is good practice. Now, I mean, that's a big word, and we can kind of unpack it as we go. But I remember I had an old supervisor. He said, you know, no matter what you're doing, you need to know why you're doing it and what you think the expected outcome is going to be. Right. So you
maybe
need to have an informed approach as to what you're doing. And when you do this intervention or you interact with a person in this way therapeutically, you have an idea about where it may lead. And I would add to that, if it creates a problem, you know what to do about it. Because sometimes really good intentioned, well-informed approaches can be disruptive to people.
I must say, you know, it seems like the overriding virtual cultural obsession among counselors is to understand why people have got the problems they've got. Obviously, we know that comes from Freud. And I noticed that, you know, and should maybe point out that there was a reaction against this in the development of solution-focused therapy. And Paul Watzlawick has been inspirational in this area, pointing out the limitations of always asking why, you know, that you can see the deficit detective at work. Can I just point out a really bizarre paradox, which is that here I am critical of therapists always asking why and searching for problems. Boy, oh boy, I wish they'd do that a bit in the field of sport and education, right? They don't do that. They just tell people, this is what you do. So they lurch into the abuse of advice giving, which also does harm. Anyway,
let me rephrase what I said, and I'll put it in my terms. So if I'm going to utilize motivational interviewing, it's going to be because it's the appropriate approach to use with this person at this point in time. And I know that if I do motivational interviewing and this person has mixed thoughts and feelings about their gambling, that I know where I'm going with that, as opposed to going in and saying, well, this must have something to do with your trauma, so we need to go back and figure out your trauma. That's what I was saying, Steve, is that I'm making an informed decision about how I'm interacting with somebody, not why they have this issue or not. But I'm coming from an informed place, not just making it up as I go along.
Yeah, you're not bullshitting.
Right, not bullshitting. There we go. You got the category. All right, Sean, what do you make of this conversation?
Oh, very, very interesting. It goes back to a conversation I had with Professor Nicole Lee many years ago on the utility of motivational interviewing. And for me, I find the biggest value in motivational interviewing in that it prevents harm. It prevents people who come with a particular approach from going down those rabbit warrens and pathways, which are their own agenda, and which usually will end up causing harm because it becomes an agenda thing. So one of the things I remember walking out of a lecture Steve did at Falkenberg Hospital, and a couple of the very clever psychiatrists said, yeah, but, you know, is there anything more than just having a conversation with person? Is there anything, any structure to this thing, you know, motivational interviewing? So I said, well, are you having those conversations? Are you applying all these principles? And the answer is no, that doesn't happen like that in a setting. And when you've got new therapists coming in who haven't developed the levels of nuance that some of the discussions this evening have shown, or the sensitivities or the awareness that the latest fad might not be the best, motivational interviewing, I find as to be a very good foundational way of having conversations with people in general. So we try and teach it right across the spectrum of anybody who comes into contact with the people that we see in some of the programs that we've got. So that because your security guard can impact the relationship of the person coming to seek help, and cause a lot of harm as well. And so the way people have conversations with people can be structured in a way that is less likely to cause harm. And I think motivational interviewing is tremendous at doing that. And I think you would admit this, largely due to the work of Gabor Mate, that trauma is the thing. It's the only thing. And I see that as being quite problematic. And I know from my own experiences, there are times when you're ready to deal with your trauma or to take your past implicit memories and turn them into explicit experiences that can add meaning to your life rather than just cause more trauma and more pain and understand why the hell you're doing these things. I do think the why question is very useful in most circumstances, but just understanding why doesn't give you a solution. And it can cause a lot of harm. I've witnessed that in my own journey and therapeutic experiences where I've got to the stage where, okay, I understand this perfectly. I understand why I'm doing it, but why am I keeping on doing it? And how do I overcome that? And so you open up a can of worms in certain cases. And then thinking about the field of addiction or traditional addiction treatment, that whole principle of approach is harmful. Its foundation is harmful. Erwin Yalom's work on group therapy is fantastic, except for the paper he wrote with somebody on 12-step programs, where he says he throws every rule that he writes in every other book out in that paper. He says you don't trust the person, you don't do this, you don't do that, and the whole field is harmful. And I had a very traumatic experience when I was doing an internship. I was young at the time. It was the first internship I did. The first session I went into was a thing they called powerlessness and damages session. And there was a young woman who had been heroin dependent for several years and been through some really rough times. Her parents had followed the so-called tough love program and kicked her out the house. She'd ended up living on the street. Now she was in rehab, and she had to admit to her very conservative parents. They basically made her admit that she'd been sleeping or having sex with multiple drug sellers. Not therapeutic about that in the slightest, in front of a group of strangers. I mean, this is a whole group, people you've met 3 days before. I walked out. To this day, I regret really not actually stopping the session. I was so shocked in it. And that's considered normal. These things of admitting that you you are incapable of being honest, for example. You know, these kinds of so-called helpful things in the addiction field are tremendously harmful. I think William Miller did that one study where they devised a recovery scale for people, and they scored them out of 10, whether you were most likely to recover or not. And obviously the individual who filled it in didn't get the result, but their therapist did. And it then revealed that, in fact, it was a totally made-up score given to the therapist, but it correlated so well with the actual outcomes, showing that the therapist's attitude has a lot to do with the outcomes. And I think that we often take on these kind of dogmatic or process-driven approaches, which come in at a level that can be very, very harmful. The thing I like about motivational interviewing is it comes in at a level that can be applied to any conversation, that even if you're dogmatic about your approach to motivational interviewing, it's not going to cause harm. And that's the beauty of it to me as a way of talking. But I think in every field where people come into contact with people, as soon as you get your own emotions involved, which is one of the reasons why I think empathy is a problem, or your own dogmas or ideologies become dominant, we're in trouble and harm is around the corner.
I wonder about outside of the world of therapy.
Yeah.
In schools and
yeah, so what is therapy? What is school? Is your teacher kind of like a proxy for a therapist when you're younger? Or therapy is sort of like a constructed time is more sensitive and more helpful than the majority of relationships we have. Because honestly, teachers can do such wonderful work, but also cause such harm. And the same teacher can cause harm to one kid and be the absolute life-saving entity for another kid. An example with me was sorry, go on.
That's exactly my experience.
Yeah, and sports coaching as well. Why do people think that screaming and shouting at a sportsman will help any more than screaming and shouting at your partner will? You know? It just creates so much emotional turmoil in the individual that how do they deal with that? You know, how do they get on with it? And if we're causing that level of unresolved emotional turmoil, we've got a problem, I think. And we must really examine whose agenda we are following just in life in general. I'm not talking about therapy now. You know, if you speak to people like Luke, who's a mutual friend of Steve and I, who's into sports, he's a sports journalist. And he wrote about this one Olympic athlete in such a compassionate way that I think if this guy had read the article and read about the things that were causing him to fall short, he wouldn't have had a problem with it. He would have actually, it would have been inspirational. But sports coaches just don't know. They are clueless when it comes to it. They just scream and shout. I don't know if I've got more to add than that at this stage, but yeah, thanks. Interesting discussion.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you
so much, Sean.
And I'm pausing because maybe it's a good opportunity for somebody else to come in, whoever is organizing the Zoom.
Michael. Go ahead. I just wanted to say
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Scott.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be talking over you. You go.
Yeah, Joel had to step out for a moment, but I was really fascinated with what you were saying, Sean. And it really made me think that why would we think counseling is any different from any other way of interacting with people, whether it be teachers, physical therapists, doctors, chiropractors, everyone causes harm to the people that they interface with in one form or another. And you just said it brilliantly. I mean, so an approach that works for one person may be very harmful to another person. And so part of it comes down to what we say all the time in MI, which is, you know, one size does not fit all. I mean, we have to customize and personalize to what would be most helpful. So I think that's really important. I wanted to mention somebody in the chat, Dr. Jen, asked about clarification between sympathy and empathy, because I think some of us, including me, were maybe taken a little back by hearing that empathy could be harmful. It completely makes sense. But empathy, as you all know, is an important part of the relational component of motivational interviewing. And so we kind of take it at face value that you have to, you know, be empathic in order to, it's necessary, but not sufficient to for the full and expert use of MI. So, wondered, you know, Steve, not to put you on the spot, if you, Sean, or Brendan wanted to approach that. I believe, Steve, you were the one who kind of introduced this concept of harmful empathy, but anybody.
I haven't, just to clarify, the idea that empathy can be used to unhelpful ends isn't my idea. I've come across it before. I think this distinction, so please don't attribute that to me, but I think this distinction between empathy and sympathy, Brendan, I bet will be able to help us with.
Okay, well, we have the lovely kind of way that I don't know, Jen, Dr. Jen Smith. Jen, I don't know, but I think you just put it lovely in the sentence there, you know, about helping people to appreciate the other's experience or the other's perspective. You know, that idea of walking a mile in their shoes, getting that sense of what that's like for the person. And the piece that I was speaking about earlier on, the example I gave where someone's tremendously sad, we're empathizing with them in this loss that they have, not in all the sadness or loss that they've had in their life. It just as much as kind of empathizing with somebody who feels guilty about having wronged somebody else in some way, and they want to repair and they want to help, you know, do something to make that relationship better or make up for their behavior in some way. Empathizing with that part of their guilt rather than empathizing with the fact they are guilty, which could sound quite blaming. Empathizing with guilt on the widespread could be something like, yeah, you are wrong. Yeah, you're right to feel guilty. Yeah, you are a bit of a shit for doing that thing. You know, that would be a very crude, wide use of empathizing with an emotion rather than empathizing with a particular narrow part of it. So, there's, you know, you could go across different aspects of different emotions. You know, people who are angry are very angry often because they're being blocked or impeded or stopped in some way from or prevented from doing something that's really important to them or moving on in some way. And like empathizing with them to be angry could be just revving them up and being more angry, whereas empathizing with what's so important to them and why this is so important to them and how they can achieve that thing instead, that's a much more useful version of it, as you know, as we break it down across the different emotions. So I suppose Jen, I could speak to your point like that we could just think of sympathy. This is a crude definition, please excuse me, but sympathy is empathizing with the emotion in general. Empathy is with the real drive behind what's happening in this instance. So that's as much as I could say to it at the moment.
Sean, you
can I add to that? This is something, because I always, people ask me that. I say empathy is identifying with and understanding an emotion. Sympathy is relief at not having the same problems as the other person. So there's an element of relief with sympathy. Sure, I'm glad I'm not in your situation, which is different. But I think, Steve, you really sort of launched quite a debate around when is empathy harmful, because most people are taught empathy as understanding the person's situation, that being good, you know, being able to walk in. Children, my understanding of their position is it becomes too complicit. I'm in that situation with them. I understand the situation with them. So they link with me quickly because they know that I empathize with their situation. But then I take them on my journey, not their journey, because I'm so invested in it. And that's when empathy becomes really dangerous. So people need to know that you can empathize with the way that they're feeling. You know, but they don't need to know that you have lived those experiences and had your own experiences imprinted upon your approach to helping that particular individual.
That's both of y'all, that's really well put. You know, and you know, operationalizing that in the interactions is really important, which goes back to what's your intention. You know, and do you know what you're doing and why you're doing it, so you're not being ignorant? What was your fourth category, Steve? Was that the ignorant one?
God, unintended harmers.
Yeah, I mean, the bullshitters are obvious, right? Because they're just bullshitting. The sadists, you know, we're not going down that road. But I think a lot of the harm that happens is unintended, with people believing what they're doing, whether it's the therapist, the teacher, the coach, the friend, the bartender, is being helpful.
Yeah. Look, I just want to just say something. There's nothing in what I've been saying that in any way is intended to devalue the constructive power of empathic listening. In fact, I feel so strongly about it. I feel we should be teaching it to kids alongside reading, writing, and arithmetic. I honestly do. So what I was concerned about, which I experienced firsthand when I met with these 10 Muslim and Jewish people, was the ease with which I could empathize with my own, okay, and the relative how much harder it was to empathize with the other side, okay? I noticed it inside myself, okay? But boy, oh boy, in the communities either side of us, they're completely polarized. And I think the tendency to empathize with your own folk and not with others is a very serious issue. So that's what I meant. Okay. Michael Flaum wants to come in. Oh, sorry, Brendan.
Yeah, I was. That's great, because I was just about to mention we've got Michael on the call here, and forgive me if I don't realize we've other medics and psychiatrists or people here as well. Hi, Michael. But it's just to draw attention to the area of iatrogenic harm, because it's very well established in medicine. And I'm delighted, Michael, you're coming in, because I was going to say, could I put Michael on the spot? I'd love to hear his thoughts on this, because iatrogenic harm, or unintended harm as a result of a treatment, whether that's, you know, a side effect from a medicine or someone doing surgery and leaving a surgical implement inside the body, or all of these possible things, is so well established in the field of medicine that we have a really solid basis for it as something to make this conversation possibly more comfortable. Because a lot of helpers don't like talking about the fact I might cause harm. They just assume I'm being kind and helpful, or I'm giving advice, or I'm doing whatever, and this is a good thing. And they don't like assuming that what they're doing could be harmful. Medicine has already looked squarely in the face of this and says a lot of what we do is harmful. And that's why I'd just love to introduce that. And Michael, you've always got really interesting things to say. And if you had anything to speak to on that, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, thanks, Brendan. And thanks, everybody. And I really appreciate this frame of thinking about harm. And I will take it down a level of nuance. I think I'm. To me, it goes back to my first real aha moment with MI, you know, which probably came 15 years after I thought I understood MI, but when I really got the basic nugget of MI, the basic idea that doing this, I knew for a long time that it didn't help. That was easy. But when I really got, that actually be making it worse, that I'm actually getting in people's way by doing this, I had to sit back on my heels for 6 months to figure out what the hell my job was and what I should do about that and the implications. And I don't think the field of medicine, and my colleagues in psychiatry included, have incorporated that harm at all. And I think one of the beauties of talking about both sides is that in my world, what is thought of as therapy or therapeutic gets sort of categorized or dichotomized into I do it or I don't do it. And I often, and you know, a lot of people, I've worked with people on the fringes and people at the lowest level of Maslow's hierarchy, and people say, like, do you do therapy? And I think they mean, like, do I do psychotherapy as the way it's envisioned with high-functioning people? And my answer is, I don't know if I do therapy in the way you may be thinking about it, but I firmly believe that every conversation, especially when you're dealing with someone with real needs, has a range of potential toward highly therapeutic and highly anti-therapeutic. And that it, and that, that there are several skills involved in pushing that toward the therapeutic range. And the thing that happens in my world a lot is people don't even think about that. I'm not doing therapy. I'm doing whatever. I'm a general practice guy. I'm trying to help this person with their diabetes. I'm a psychiatrist and I'm trying to help this person with their panic disorder. I don't do therapy. And I reject that entirely. I think that every conversation they have, even if it's a conversation about the side effects of the medicine for your panic disorder, has a range of therapeutic and anti-therapeutic potential. And I don't think my colleagues, and I don't think the field of medicine even thinks about this. So,
Michael, can I just share one thing I really enjoy is that this can make your head hurt because you're wondering about whether you're helpful. I've been having a lot of fun in sport, but God knows why I didn't do this 30 years ago. I just ask the people, you know, just say, how helpful is this? And I do 2-3 times a session. Because it then begs the question, what could be more helpful or less helpful? And then you can follow their energy. So I don't know. It's been a revelation.
I was going to just say something hopeful, which is I had the opportunity about 2 weeks ago to meet with a leadership of a very large health system, like a multi-billion dollar health system, and just the leadership. And I was so pleased because they said, there's one of our leaders who is a GI surgeon. And at the end of every single session he meets with a patient, the last question he asks is, did you get what you needed today? And is there something else I could do? And then I ran into this guy and they introduced me in the hall and he had been in clinic. And he had asked the last patient, he saw that question. And so there is hope. I didn't mean to be sweeping, but I think that type, you know, here he is a GI surgeon, and he's like completely understands that it's important that he tune in and that he have a potential for to be helpful.
I just wanted to jump in, Michael, because you're reminding me, all of your thoughtful comments are reminding me of a little tiny argument I had with a surgeon not too long ago who said that, psychotherapy isn't technical or invasive like surgery is. And I thought to myself, actually, it's both. Can you get more invasive than talking to somebody about their sexual trauma history or anything like that? And what I think what we're saying now is there's a lot of nuance in what we do, and even in brief counseling conversations. And if we're not tuned in to that nuance, we can be creating, causing harm. And it makes me, I'm hopeful and worried about the global move towards task shifting from trained psychotherapists to peer or community health workers. I think we have to go that way because we don't have enough mental health providers. It's very important to have a step care model. But I also worry that the training of these folks is very, very minimal. And I worry about unintended harm that could come to that.
And I agree with that as well too, and I think Steve was right. You know, I keep landing back to this unintended sort of harm, where you know the best intentions or the best policies or the best ideas, they're not always thought through. You know, peer support, yep, that sounds like a great idea. Partners in Recovery, they have in Australia, sounds like a great idea. But there's a difference between having a conversation with somebody you have some shared experience with versus somebody that knows how to facilitate and guide a process. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's just I'm thinking about the peer thing because one of the things that I do a lot of is peer facilitated interventions and peer led interventions in the field of drug use, and particularly injecting drug use. One of the things that I've been trying to do within communities that we work in is turn every point of contact into a less harmful point of contact, through teaching something. So that, Steve, you and I have spoken about this before, about how can we turn motivational interviewing into something that becomes the sort of every man's way of having a conversation within a particular environment, you know, that you can reduce it into the simplest possible form so that all the theory that's gone into it and the thought that's gone into it isn't front and foremost of the training of the people, but the actual technique, even if it becomes a little bit formulaic, is at least going to stop causing harm, you know, and put it into that context. And with us, the biggest thing to teach peers is when they're out of their depth. You know, they're great for reaching hard to reach populations. They're great for helping create an environment that is conducive to people coming into it. Just the same way that the guy that's running the local, we call them spaza shops, but illegal off license of alcohol, training him how to have a conversation with the guy that comes in blind drunk on a Saturday morning and he's moaning about his state of drunkenness, training him to have a conversation that might be slightly more useful, like a brief intervention. Those kinds of interventions are very helpful, but they become problematic when you've got people with egos who now think they're trained therapists.
Exactly. And I just tell you a funny story, I think, or just a reflection, Sean. This topic for tonight, homology, please don't take that word seriously. It's just a joke and a springboard.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, good. But what we're trying to do is clarify what is helpfulness, if we think about it. And there was a moment when I was writing the fourth edition of Motivational Interviewing with Bill Miller, when I suggested to him and the commissioning editor that we call the book Helpfulness, right? And we have a subtitle with Motivational Interviewing. Ptung, I got shot down, right? Big time. And I just laughed. But I feel that's where we're going, is to write something. I'm not going to do it, right? But why is it that these efforts to be helpful have involved constructing so many specialties and so many schools of therapy when some of the fundamentals of what it means to be helpful get lost? And so I couldn't agree with you more, Sean. Something I'm writing at the moment is a book on how to give advice helpfully, but that's a little part of it. Yeah.
I'm holding in mind everything we've been talking about, because we've kind of pushed the boundaries. And we you know, it seems like the energy of the conversation has been around this sort of, you know, unintended harm and, you know, the best intentions of trying to be helpful, sort of that sort of unconscious incompetence or even conscious incompetence that can happen. I hear what you're saying, Steve, that harmology, you know, it's a word. But I think it's a good word to kind of get the thought process going in people, to be thinking about harm and about, you know, how we can cause harm even if what we're trying to do is be as helpful as possible.
The word resonates badly with me, homology. I must be honest, Steve. I was going to bring it up at the beginning, but I thought maybe not, because, and I'm going to offend some people here. The term addictionology, you know, homology, helpology, crapology, you know, it takes ownership of stuff, which is just like really sits badly with me. So I'm glad we're on the same page with that. I was going to have a private conversation with you about the word, but sometimes we need sarcasm font.
Yeah. No, it was a word. It's a way to kind of, you know, get a conversation going. Certainly, we're not. Steve doesn't want this codified and concretized, and there'd be a PhD program in the study of harmology.
Oh my God!
With an edited book, you know.
Maybe in the future we should have a session on what is helpfulness.
Yeah. Well, that does beg the question, doesn't it? You know, if we can identify that what's not helpful, then that's the stuff we don't want to do. But then what is helpful? And Sean, I was going back to what you were saying about you know, how do we kind of distill or boil motivational interviewing down in a way that can, you know, be helpful for people like the guy who's doing the off-license thing or whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, how much motivational interviewing does somebody really need to know to be helpful? Right? Is it, you know, we just listening and empathizing, that can be nice and it can be warm and someone can feel heard, but that may not in and of itself be helpful. You know, so how much do you actually need to know? What are the key ingredients in helping somebody make changes in their life, whether it's in the classroom, the football pitch, or in the therapist room? I wonder if there's common denominators there. And Brendan had his hand up. I wonder if he wants to join in again.
Just two brief comments, Joel. One being, we know a lot of the things that can be helpful across psychotherapies, and we know that Terry Moyers and Bill Miller, the book that they wrote about that, is tremendously helpful about pointing to that. But also to point to something you said a minute ago, how much MI can be helpful. We got to make sure we don't get caught and fall into our own trap here of thinking MI is the helpful way of being, because we know right across all of the different across all of the different approaches that the model or the method accounts for very little of the outcome. So we know it's the relationship, we know it's other environmental factors, we know it's inner resources that the person has. These are the meta factors that matter. So it's just, if I could, I just want to kind of catch your question and broaden it a little bit, going,
yeah, please.
Not just what in MI, what is it that can be helpful in a more general sense, as kind of Steve said, and to just be brave enough, the second part of what I want to say is kind of connected to that, be brave enough to kind of criticize MI and say, here is where it is really not helpful. This is the limits of MI, and this is where we got to stop kidding ourselves in saying that it's MI for all things. Because you and I would have had a lot of conversations about when to use MI and when not. That part, stop kidding ourselves about that, also speaks to the whole topic tonight of whether you like the word harmology or not. But stop kidding ourselves about the fact that we harm people in our job with the best intentions of the world, in all that we're trying and hoping and wishing to do for people. We unintentionally harm people probably much more regularly than what we imagine. So just wanted to jump in with a couple of those pointers.
Wouldn't that be an interesting thing to try to measure and understand?
Keep going.
Well, just because a lot of that harm that happens in our interactions with people, we're not aware of, other than maybe they don't show up again, or it's the classroom, they quit talking about it, or they don't bring the topic up again with the coach, right? They avoid talking about it because of the harm that it caused the last time they brought it up.
Oh,
really? I came across an elite athlete, I won't even mention the gender or sport, who played through injury in order to pretend that everything was all right to such an extent that he's just had back surgery.
Yeah. It was
okay
for him to have that conversation. It was not okay for him to be to acknowledge the pain or suffering he was going through. It was not okay. Whatever messages he got, he'd been very definitely harmed by them. And if we go, it might sound a little dramatic to say this, Steve, but he self-harmed on the back of that.
It's exactly right. Two nights ago, one of my daughter's friends, he's an international rugby player, young fella, 22, sits in the back garden in a barbecue, and I say, how are you doing? And he says, yeah, I'm fine. He's fine. He's playing in the World Cup and everything. And I say, no, what's your health like? What's your body like? And he starts rubbing his knee. And so I say, what's going to happen on Saturday? He says, what do you mean? I play through it. I play through the pain.
It is interesting. I mean, Steve, I wasn't even thinking about this, but I'm working with a professional athlete in therapy, and part of his issue is the way that he was stood down from going up to a national level and how the coaches lied to him. And they didn't tell him the truth and the harm that that has caused this man in terms of his whole life since being a boy was about playing the sport. And just had a door slammed with a lie, and he found out, you know, as you do. And, you know, they thought that they were letting him down easy, but they actually were just lying to him.
Yeah. I wonder I've got a feeling this is coming to a natural end, this conversation. I wonder whether anybody else wants to contribute anything.
Can I make one final point? So listening to your conversation towards the end here, you know, if we had to translate this into normal people kind of language, and I want to take a slightly different approach here because I think when you see motivational interviewing as a therapeutic approach, then it has got limits to its utility. But when you see it as a way of having a conversation, I think that it's a good framework and fallback position to in any circumstance, quite frankly, because all it really we're trying to do is tell people don't argue, acknowledge self-efficacy and small positive change, don't ridicule, encourage the person and be kind, you know, and without compromising yourself. You know, that's where some of the directiveness might come in at times. But it's about keeping the relationship and building relationships. We know that relationships are essential to change, along with the environment and all the other things that happen, you know, along with it. But emotional interviewing, if you use it, it kind of reduces the chance of you screwing up the relationship. And to me, that can happen in any context. So I'm not living in a dream world where I think emotional interviewing is the be all and end all of everything. I just think that if people applied it more and didn't just be dismissive and reduce it to say, oh, well, that's what we do anyway, and be more conscious about their conversations as a whole, and we're just kinder to people around them without being sort of sugary sweet, I think we'd be in a much better place, and I think a lot less harm would be caused.
All right, thanks, Sean. That's a nice way to pull that together. Sure. I think I'm borrowing this from Helen Mintham, the idea of having helpful conversations with people or somebody in the MI world, right? And maybe it's MI, maybe it's something like MI, but it's actually going to be helpful. And it could have all of those elements. How about anybody else out in the audience? Anything, anybody else want to share some thoughts, or you can just unmute and join right in. George, my man.
Hey, so thanks for the invitation. I think Heather was the one who brought this up, and again, putting pieces together and that sense of purpose and guidedness. I was, as that discussion was happening, I was thinking about all the folks who were interested in helping people explore their trauma without a sense of guiding. And I thinking about how often MI is used with exposure therapies, whether it be with veterans or trauma, and the unwittingness. And because I've seen this happen without that sense of direct observation, that entering that pain with folks who that's their goal, that the eyes glaze over and they don't resolve the pain, Brandon, they re-experience the pain, which is not helpful. and it can be actually a devastating session. So I was just wanting to share that was important conversation that you all had, the need for that we need to be very purposeful, because without that sense of purpose, yes, I'm helping relieve this person's suffering by exploring their trauma, when in fact it's just re-traumatizing, and that need for caution. The other comment I had, Joel, was the fact that I'm actually Synanon trained, and I watched people be destroyed in the game. And I remember having to take one patient to the psychiatric emergency room as a result of being gamed on the hot seat. Sean, you might resonate with that. So those were my two comments. Thank you so much.
No, thanks, George. Yeah, no, my addiction training was second generation Synanon people. I've seen a lot of people, you know, talk about Heather, talk about invasive. How counseling and therapy can be invasive. Hot seating somebody and giving them the old verbal haircuts can certainly be about as invasive as you can get. Anybody else? Reflections, thoughts? Anybody want to try to put a summary of sorts to give this conversation? We'd be grateful for that. Or at least get some key things that stood out to you that we could finish on.
I think we're ready to say goodbye.
I think we're getting there too, Steve. Well, look, I think this was a great way to kick off. And one of the things I love about this conversation that we have with our colleague, Steve, is we know how to start it, but we don't know where it's going to go. And it goes to where it needs to go. And Sean, Michael, George, Brendan, everybody who's kind of been participating in the chat, we really appreciate it. Looking forward to more conversations with our little MIB community around the world. And, you know, we're just really grateful for you guys coming along, y'all coming along and spending an hour and a half with us. I know I always end up having more to think about than when I started. So it's much appreciated.
And thanks to Heather and to Scott for their help.
Yeah, 100%. Scott, you got the pinning down. That'd be great. And, you know, Heather and Scott, if you can hang out for a second, I'd like to catch up with you. Steve, I know you got a football match to attend to. So,
all right. Well, bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you, Steve. That was amazing. Really appreciate it.
Cheers, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks, folks. See ya. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Brendan.
Bye.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Yeah, well,
have a good evening, nice. Steve.